Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Well, listen, we're going to start a series today that we've been praying about and looking forward to for at least 6 weeks. A number of you have been praying for since the end of December last year. We're calling it You Are, the series You Are. We've been teaching a version of this pretty much for 21 years since last November. The student ministry has heard this series about every 2 to 3 years for 21 years. And then about 4 years ago, Norman Furley was teaching this series up there, and they loved it. And then some people said, well, you need to tell this to our parents. So he taught this to the parents of the adolescents, and they said, why aren't we hearing this in the pulpit? And why doesn't the whole church hear about this series? Because it's so important. It has so much power. It can just absolutely transform a life, a church, and maybe even potentially a city and a state and a country, whatever. I mean, it's good. I want you to continue to be praying because this is a spiritual event. And what I've learned over the years is the most we can do is to pray. The least we can do is pray. That our hearts would be tender towards what God would teach us. And then we'd be praying for the people that are visiting us and participating with us, okay? Here's kind of part one about the series that you need to know about. You got to go to the whole thing. We've brought it all the way to Easter. It's 10 weeks long. Norman Furley and I will be actually taking turns going back and forth since he has a different way of looking at things than I do, and we're going to complement each other quite well in this epic as we go through it together. But if you just kind of come for the first few weeks and miss the ending, you're probably going to leave feeling hopeless. Like the hero came too late. Like there's something else to this, and you'll feel maybe even angered. So you can't just go to the beginning and miss the end. If you just say, okay, fine, I can't take the stuff at the beginning, I'll just skip to the end, then you lose the context. If there is a happily ever after, I won't tell you, but if there is, you won't know what you went through to get there. The power of the Spirit in your life will be void. The transformational reality of the resurrection of Jesus Christ won't be appreciated. And so you need to hear the whole thing. If you are in and out because of travel, then by all means, go to the website and download it on the podcast. If you're visiting today, boy, you're going to really want to know how this thing plays out. This is a great story. This is the greatest story ever. It took thousands of years to be told. And if, let me just put it another way. The way to an empty tomb is through a mountain, Mount Sinai. And you have to go through Sinai, where the Ten Commandments are given, to appreciate what took place on a cross and in a tomb. Well, with that in mind, okay, you try to do and promise you'll come to everything that you can. This little bullet point here about who you are, that's an outline of the series itself. That helps us kind of negotiate what we're going to be doing. We'll spend a couple of weeks or 3 weeks on each one of those little bubbles there. But it's also a truth. You are a product of what you believe, how you behave, who you befriend, and what you do with your life. That's not just the outline of our series. It is the truth. You are. That's who you are. You're just you're a conglomeration, I guess, of beliefs and memories. And those beliefs and those memories are based on what you believe and how you behave and who you befriend and then what you do in your life. If you want to experience it, even from a biblical standpoint, you can see that the Bible writers saw this. And the teachings of Jesus and the discipleship of Jesus, he played these four points out. I mean, if you look at just the first one, what you believe. You are what you believe. It certainly starts there. And that's why Paul says in Romans, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You have to think right. Philippians, he gets quite specific. Look what it says. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. You need to think about these things because you're a product of what you believe, but you're also a product of how you behave because of what you're thinking, often that affects your behavior. Sometimes it starts with behavior, but usually it's a consequence of that. And that's why the very next verse in Philippians is following those, that verse about how to think right. He's telling you how to act right. Look, whatever you've learned from me or received or heard from me or seen in me, put into practice. And then the God of peace will be with you. So you are what you believe and how you behave, but also who you befriend. Look what it says in Proverbs. It says, one who walks with a wise man, he grows wise. And a person who has companions that are fools, they suffer harm. Look, in Paul's writing to the Corinthians, he is able to combine all three of these points of who you are in just a couple of verses. Look what it says on the screens there. It says, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. It's who you befriend. Become sober-minded. That's what you believe in your and as you ought to. And stop sinning. That's how to behave. I had a seminary professor that was very influential in my life. And he said, look, who you'll be in 5 years from now is a consequence of what books you read and the people you spend time with. What you believe and who you befriend. And that'll affect how you behave. When I talk to people and they're having a hard time in life, I say, well, what books are you reading? And who are you spending time with? And tell me about your behavior. But it's not just those three, right? It's not just what you believe and how you behave and who you befriend, but it's also what you do in your life. There ought to be a sense of destiny about every single person, that their life is not wasted, that there's a reason that you are alive. There's so many ways that you could have died, but you didn't, and you're here today. And there should be a feeling that God, in his power and his plan, has allowed you to survive so that you could be used by him for things that would echo into forever, that you wouldn't just fill a hole in the ground, that you would leave a hole when you left. That's why Paul writes this in his letter to the Ephesians. As a prisoner of the Lord, that's his reason to exist, then I urge you that you ought to live a life worthy of your calling that you have received. Live a life worthy of the calling that God gave you, you see, that God gave you. That he has a script for you and he wants you to play that part. So that's it. There's the four of them there. What you believe, how you behave, who you befriend, and what you do with your life. And listen, I'll bet you have experiences like I have with people that have adverse effects to these four major points of your existence. I know people that, for example, this is classic. It's happened several times. I've met people that they believe that they are losers. Some bully in their life, like their parents or a coach or a classmate or something, convinced them in their minds that they were a loser. And so how do they behave? They behave like one. And I've seen them. I've just seen it played out in their lives. They get a fabulous job right in their sweet spot for what they should be doing. And they sabotage it. They figure out some way to get fired. They date someone that would be the answer to their every prayer about who they should marry. And they cheat on them. And then what do? They hang around a bunch of losers that continue the messaging that we are all a bunch of losers. And what do they do with their life? Waste it. But listen, every counselor knows this, every football coach knows this, every rehab center, every youth ministry, they know, military leaders, they know these four points, and they can change a human being for the better if they apply what you believe, how you behave, who you befriend, and what you do with your life. I mean, think about it. If you want to change a group of people, you apply this. And so in the military, it's duty, honor, country. That's what they're teaching you. There's usually some sort of value to aspire to. You could win the Super Bowl. You could be sober. And then attachment to that belief system is also where you fit in. And usually where you fit in is you're not so special. Right? I mean, in the military, they take all your identity away with your hair and outfits. In a coach, they put you in uniforms. A lot of times they'll have a big t-shirt. Your practice jersey says, Team Me. If you go to a clinic that's 28 days long, they'll tell you, look, I don't care where you've been or what you've done. You're just like everyone else in the room. And that's important because that's going to affect the way you behave. Because the next process of turning people into champions is to get them to express themselves in ways that's true about their beliefs. And we're in the military. They say, hey, Biff, I want you to go throw yourself on that razor wire while the rest of us crawl over you. We're going to put our foot right in the middle of your back and we're going to climb over you. And Biff says, you bet. That's the way it works. Regiments are changed. Workouts are altered so that you do things that you didn't think you could do otherwise. Discipline is added significantly. And again, if you want to change your life, you probably need to get up on time and be punctual. That's how you change a life. And then what about who you befriend? It's all part of the big thing. In the military, they put you in a barracks with like-minded individuals that believe in duty, honor, and country. They put you in a dorm room with other football players or baseball team members or whatever that plan on winning district or state or the national championship. And then they weed out the doubters and the people that aren't disciplined because they know that those people have the power to wreck that train. They have to get those naysayers out of there. And that's what happens in rehabilitation centers as well. And at the end of the day, what do you have? You have life stories to tell. You have trophies on a wall. You have a sober chip for a year or 10. You have a man who at every morning at the sunrise is raising a flag that's on a pole in his front yard because he believes it. He's lived it. His best buddies were in a hole with him. And he has a sense of fate in his life. That's what happens when it's done right. It can change everything. I want you to know these 4 points. What you believe, how you behave, who you befriend, what you do with your life. We're going to take them off the screens. And I'm going to ask you to turn to a friend. And you have 40 seconds to get all 4 of those right. You can't look at your bulletins. Ready? Go. Okay, how'd you do? Did you get them all? We're going to go over this a few times for the next 10 weeks. We're going to spend today talking about belief, what you believe. And the most important thing to believe is about God. Absolutely, the most important thing about you is what you believe about God. I would say that even if you don't believe in God, I'd say that belief is the most important thing about you. Because what you believe about God is premium. It's the thing that affects all the rest of your life. And you need to believe this about God, that God is holy. He's absolutely pure and perfect. He is other than us. He is perfect. Another description of this synonym that's used is the word righteous. In Hebrew, it looks like this, that he is tzaddik. It means that there is a standard. Tzaddik is a standard of righteousness that is complete. It is wanting in nothing. It is absolute and is in contrast to everything else. Anything that deviates from the standard is sin. It is unrighteous. And God is righteous. His holiness is righteous. His judgment is righteous and perfect. It is without error. And there is no protest. And when you think about the holiness of God, you need to certainly believe this in your belief system. If God is holy, then you need to fear God. You must fear God. Because of the nature of his holiness and the perfection of his righteousness, it has a consequence on us that's fear. Now listen, I know in churches, first of all, we don't talk much about the fear of God in churches today. I don't know what happened. I don't know where we got distracted, but it was unfortunate. And even today, when people talk about the fear of God, they qualify it. They say, well, fear means respect, or it's a feeling of awe. The problem is that when you open your Bibles, you don't see that. I mean, you don't see people saying, well, now I respect God. You see people cower in terror. When you open the book and you read about experiences that people have with God, holy men and women that have actually experienced something of his holiness, his righteousness, his perfection, they want to die. They lose their breath. They mumble over and over, holy. Holy, holy. Sure, there's respect, there's some feeling of awe, but there is trembling. And I know it's not, I guess, contemporary to talk about this, but it's also true that we need to fear God because he's worthy of fear. In Psalm 111 and Proverbs verse 1, or chapter 1, verse 7, it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." That's where wisdom starts. It starts with the fear of the Lord. Sure, respect, yes, awe, but terror of who he is and his righteous standard that we must live up to. There's a million different things to talk about when we talk about God, but the place to start is his holiness, and the consequence is to fear that. If you fear him, it gives you the power that is part of that holiness. If there is no fear, there's consequences in your behavior and who you befriend and what you do with your life. It's a good thing. I know it's not contemporary. It's old school to talk about fire and brimstone. I'll have you know that God is old school. He's very old school. And while the methodology of fire and brimstone may not be as effective as it used to be, the power of the truth still is. What is difficult, however, is to conceptualize what it means to understand God's holiness, you know, to grasp it within our minds because we are so different. And it is, especially in our current context, it is so foreign to our understanding of who God is. But what we can do is we can look into the Bible and we can look at passages that talk about things that God says, well, this is a holy thing. And then someone kind of bumps into it in a half-hearted, disinterested way, and they have a consequence that they weren't expecting. It's kind of like when, you know, you bump into the table or something and you stub your toe against something at the house and it just absolutely breaks your toe. And you think, wait a minute, I thought this was like an IKEA, you know, plastic bench here that was supposed to move when I kicked it, and it turns out to be a mahogany heirloom that's not budging at all. Your toe breaks, it doesn't even know you're there. That's what happens when people recklessly bump into something that's holy and have to live with the consequences. An easy place to start about holy things you bump into would be the Ten Commandments. In Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5, God lays out 10 things that are expected in his righteousness if you want to live a life that fears him and enjoys him. And so the first four, maybe five, but certainly the first four are set apart to talk about the things of God. The first one, it says, "I'm the Lord your God who saved you from Egypt. You shall have no other gods before you." Absolutely, makes perfect sense. Don't make idols. They won't even touch who I am. And then the third one is you should never use my name in vain because my name is holy. Why don't you turn your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 24. And in Leviticus chapter 24, there's an incident that takes place. Now people, because God's name was separate and not like any other name, they would make up nicknames for him. Occasionally they would call him Jehovah. But mostly they used words like Elohim or El Shaddai, words that are descriptive because they didn't want to say his name. One day, a fight broke out between a couple of men, and in the midst of that fight, I'm sure a crowd gathered because, we love fights. But anyway, somebody gets hurt, and he says the Lord's name carelessly, recklessly, in a cavalier way, and then everything stops. And the crowd gets quiet, and no one knows what to do. And so they're so perplexed that they call Moses in and say, look, let's quarantine him because his lips have said the name, and let's put him out of town until Moses tells us what to do. And in verse 13, this is what the Lord tells Moses on how they should deal with this individual. And then the Lord said to Moses, take the blasphemer outside of camp. All those who heard him as witnesses are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him. Now say to the Israelites, if anyone curses his God, he will be held responsible. Anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord will be put to death. The entire assembly must stone him. Whether an alien or a native born, when they blaspheme his name, he must be put to death. The commandment reads this: you shall not take the Lord your God's name in vain. The Lord will not leave unpunished who has taken his name in vain. And so they do it. They take the man outside of town. The men who heard the voice put their hands on him as a witness. Then they back up and they kill him and leave nothing but a mound of rocks behind. Now, what would happen if we were still practicing that today? There'd be mounds of rocks, wouldn't there? Maybe a lot. I'd say not very many, actually. It only takes one or two mounds about every 5 years. What would happen is our belief would change. Now we'd fear God, and that would affect our behavior and who we'd befriend. We wouldn't be hanging around people that use the Lord's name in vain and recklessly, carelessly, inadvertently, right? Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. That wasn't my voice. It would certainly determine what we did in life. It has an effect. Wait, was there a feeling of awe that day? You bet. But there was terror when that sun went down. And I don't blame the Jews of the day for not ever even wanting to say the name. Even to this day, people that appreciate the meaning of the third commandment will write the word God, G-D. They don't want to put the letters together. Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. The fourth commandment reads this: remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. For 6 days the Lord made the heavens and earth and the sea and all that was in it, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So we have a separate, distinct standard of God that's on Saturday. Now, while this doesn't apply to us today, we can understand what happens when somebody bumps up against it. If you'll turn into the next book of the Bible, Numbers chapter 15, let me give you some context. In Numbers chapter 15, the first several verses are talking about accidental sins. It's called unintentional sins. Seven times he'll use the word unintentional to describe sometimes you and I don't even know we're making a mistake that's violating the perfection of God. And the writer Moses is saying, look, there's a payment that you can make for that. There's alms that you can serve, and that will make things right again. But he said, look, if you commit an intentional sin, a premeditated sin, actually the word means a high-handed sin, you know what you're doing and you do it anyway, you are on your own. For those of you with Catholic backgrounds, an unintentional sin, venial sin, this high-handed sin, a mortal sin. Look at verse 31, what he says about these mortal sins, these intentional, premeditated sins. Because that person has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment, that person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be on him. Verse 32. Now, while the sons of Israel were out in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath. Oh, no. And they didn't know what to do. And so they waited for Moses, and Moses waited for the Lord in verse 34. And they put him into custody because they did not know what to be declared about what to be done with him. And then the Lord says to Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And so the congregation brought him outside of the camp, and they stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord commanded him. Was there a feeling of awe that afternoon? You bet. But there was a feeling of fear. They feared God. That's why the entire community stoned this man to death. Because he was working? No. Because he thought Saturday was like Tuesday. Because he thought a holy day was like any other day of the week. He didn't care what God thought. And because he had this belief that all the days are the same, he had a behavior that led to a pile of rocks and a lesson for everyone else to learn. What would it be like if That were still going on today, and we had to express ourselves this way with the Sabbath. Hey, buddy, I'm going to put up my fence on the Sabbath. You want to come help me? Are you kidding me? Hey, the only way you're going to get this project done is if you work late on the Sabbath, then the project's not going to get done. Because I fear God, and that leads to behavior. And maybe I've got to quit hanging around with you because you keep drawing me out to these things. Because I'm living for something much bigger than getting a project done or finishing that fence. You see? There's also in the Bible stories of holy wars. If you'll turn to Joshua chapter 7, I'll tell you about holy wars, particularly holy battles. And what that means is it's a battle that belongs to the Lord. And some of you know the story of Joshua and the Jericho story, where Joshua and his army marches around Jericho several times and the walls fall down. That was a holy battle. It was the first battle when Israel takes the promised land. It's very important that they understand that God was doing the warring for them. The battle belongs to the Lord, right? So what that means is, here's how it works in practice, is everything from that battle victory belongs to God. So when the walls come down, then there's no plunder for anyone else because the plunder is God's. And so they just, everything that's part of that just goes into the mound and then they light it on fire because it belongs to God. It's a logical expression of, boy, this was a God thing. Great, then it belongs to him. It's a holy war. Well, after Jericho, they go on to the next little township, and it's an easy victory. It's Ai, or Ai, and they're supposed to take these guys left-handed, but they don't. They are absolutely routed, and 38 Israelis are killed when they were running for their lives. And because of that, the passage says, and the hearts of the people melted and became like water, because they felt like God had left them. Where'd he go? I mean, they were, what? And then while Joshua now has torn his robe, his face down in the dirt, wailing to God that it would be better if he wouldn't have set us up for this kind of expectation that he would be there for them, God responds to Joshua's prayer with verse 10, chapter 7 in Joshua. And Jehovah, the Lord, said to Joshua, stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded you to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things, they have stolen, and they have lied. What? Yeah. And so Joshua lines everybody up, tribe by tribe, they go through, and then house by house, and then person by person, and they find the man who is actually coveted, stolen, and then lied about it. His name is Achan. And here's what Joshua says to him in verse 19. And so Joshua says to Achan, my son, give glory, see, to the holiness, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give him praise. Tell me what you've done, and do not hide it from me. And then Achan replied, it's true. I've sinned against the Lord, see, the God of Israel. This is what I've done. When I saw the plunder, a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing about 50 shekels, I coveted them and I took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent. The silver is underneath them. And so this is what they do. It's predictable because we've heard two stories already. They take Achan out of the community, and they take Achan and his wife and his daughters and his sons and his goat and his cow and his donkey and his tent. Everything that had anything to do with this. Because everybody was, in many ways, probably conspiring. It's a very small tent. What are you hiding, Dad? What are you doing? And then they stoned the family and the donkey and the goat and the sheep and the tent. And then they light it on fire, just like they did in Jericho. And they build this mound in this valley and name it after Achan. His Achan, they call it the Valley of Achor, which means trouble. It's the Valley of Trouble. And listen, when the Bible says they made a mound, I know you and I are probably thinking something 4 or 6 feet high. It might have been as big as this building. And do you know why they made a mound as big as this building? There were two monuments made up until this point. One outside of Gilgal when they crossed the river, because it was a monument of God's presence and his mercy on them. And now this mound, a mound of trouble. So that every single time you're going from your house to the Wilson's house and you drive by that mound and the kids say, "What's that for, Dad?" You say, "I'll tell you why. We're going through the valley of trouble, because that's the mount of trouble, because you shall not lie and you shall not steal and you shall not covet, because God is holy. His standard is righteousness, perfect righteousness. And this is what happens when you bump up against it and think it's not that important." See, if you don't fear God, it leads to behavior and it leads to who you befriend and what you do with your life. And if you do fear God, there's a story to be told there too. It's not the God we want necessarily, it is the God we need. We need this kind of God. We have to have this idealized but actualized expression of perfection. It has to be this way. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It is where we start. It is where the power is. In your bulletins, look at this. I love this verse in chapter 20 of Exodus. That's where the Ten Commandments are. We studied, what, 5 or 6 of them today, and what happens when you violate them. Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid." Don't be afraid. Fear. "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you and to keep you from sinning." Do not be afraid. God is testing you so that you'll fear him and you won't sin. You know, people that are reckless with sin, it's because they don't fear God. "Oh, I'm struggling with this particular sin." Struggling? What would happen if there was a pile of rocks with your name on it? How'd the struggle, you'd probably end the struggle, wouldn't you? If we take the holiness of God and his absolute standard of righteousness seriously, then we're not playing around with the commandments of God. It changes our behavior. It changes who we befriend.